understand geopolitics, you must have the freedom to be honest. The More Freedom Foundation podcast.
Hello, Rob. How have you been this week?
Not bad, Rory. Not bad. How are things going with you?
Yeah, things are going well. I assume you want to talk about the recent elections?
Yes, I'd love to talk about the recent elections, which have happened, but have not
in Northern Ireland. I'm sure you want to do a whole episode on the recent local elections in Northern Ireland.
Definitely, Rory. I am deeply conversant with the minutiae of elect. Does Northern Ireland currently have a government?
Not really, but sort of. But yes, the Northern Ireland Assembly is currently on a hiatus.
It's been years, right?
No. That the time it was off for years, they were back for a bit, and now they're off again.
Oh, all right. Well, was the election exciting in some regards?
Not terribly exciting. Mostly just Sinn Féin have got the biggest majority so far.
Well, that is kind of exciting from the perspective that that's not... that
hasn't helped the DUP, who are slowly losing votes by huffing.
So is it fair to say that Sinn Féin is traditionally, which I've just mispronounced and I apologize, is is traditionally more a southern party? I mean, that's the party of liberation, right? Is that fair?
They're not. It's complicated. They would like a united Ireland, yes, but a lot in the south of Ireland would not be keen on them, although they are slowly becoming more popular down south as well.
Well, we'll have to stop now, or we're going to spend the next 45 minutes talking. We'll have to do an episode, actually, of Rory Explains Northern Ireland. Today, unfortunately, we are in the position of talking about an election that has not happened yet as of recording, but will have occurred by the time this is published on Monday. And unfortunately, I think we've all got a pretty good sense of how it's going to go. Miraculous surprises are possible. And if there is a miraculous surprise, there will no doubt be a lot more turkey content very quickly on a variety of channels. But I think it is most likely that Turkey's President Erdogan will win the runoff and will continue to be in power. And I would say that one of the main reasons that he's going to remain in power is the question of Turkey and the Kurds. This is now the second solid opportunity to get rid of Erdogan that I believe is being squandered because of the Turkish-Kurdish issue. I think I'm tempted to say it's because of Turkey's irrational, you know, dislike of the Kurds. And I do think that it is irrational and larger than it should be and creates stumbling blocks and is the reason Erdogan is able to stay in power. But there is a lot to this conflict, and Turks are not entirely crazy to be irritated or afraid of some Kurdish terrorist groups, which are, of course, distinct from the vast majority of Kurds. But we'll hopefully unpack all of that as we dive in today.
So what would you define as the Kurdish people?
starting off with an easy one there, right?
I thought I'd give you a lowball.
But that's a great place to start because it's a lot more complex than you might think just reading a New York Times article or something along those lines. There are factions. The Kurdish population is divided between Iraq, Syria, Turkey, and Iran. There are multiple factions within each one of those geographic distributions. I was reading something this morning that divided up just the Turkish Kurds into four separate types. And the author acknowledged that even that is a dramatic oversimplification. You've got your nationalist Kurds who support the PKK. You've got your religiously conservative Kurds who support Erdogan. You've got your religiously conservative Kurds who hate Erdogan. You've got your go along, get along, I don't want to be political Kurds who were content to try to profit from Turkey's economic boom and would really wish people just weren't talking about politics at all. But even that dramatically undersells the complexity. And we should say at the outset that I'm inevitably going to get some of this stuff wrong, but I want to bring some people into some of the complexity here so they begin to understand things. maybe the best example, I may have used this before, I don't know if I've used it before on the podcast, but one of my favorite examples of the Turkish-Kurdish question in Turkey is a woman I briefly dated back in 2016. And she was from the east of the country. She was from Diyarbakir. And it was fascinating just how changeable her self-identity was. If the PKK, the Turkish, officially designated by the U.S. government, the Turkish government, as a terrorist group, the PKK terrorist group had carried out a bombing, she was proudly Turkish and she was outraged. However, if the Turkish government at that period of time was engaged in large-scale attacks against the PKK or destroying the downtown of Diyarbakir, which is something that happened in the 2015-2016 period, then she was proudly Kurdish. So just, you know, one person could associate themselves with both identities. And that's the, I think that's one thing to become aware of. There's not anywhere near as hard and fast a, say, a color line as there are with some U.S. Issues over the years, or anywhere near as hard and fast as, say, the Palestinian-Israel distinction, which is often brought up as a comparison. I think there are some poorer Kurds who, for whatever reason, may find themselves more easily marginalized or what have you, but there is the capacity to sort of switch and go back and forth. And part of the problem is that the Turkish state has in a variety of different ways, sometimes in a friendly way, often in a very violent way, has refused to admit that there is such a thing as a Kurd and just assumes that they are all Turks. Whereas in Israel, I mean, I don't think there's any Israeli government who's been like, ah, you know, wait, you're all Israelis. Come, vote, be part of us. That's not exactly how it works with the Palestinians. So the Israel-Palestine parallel fails, I think.
But I've seen them almost described as they're more about what they're not as opposed to what they are. You know, they're not Turkish, they're not Iranian, they're not Syrian. They're a unique identity, but that has, you know, ebbed and flowed over time. And also they are often very persecuted. Can you see them ever getting more autonomy like they had in Syria?
Well, as they technically still have in Syria, in Iraq would probably be the place where they had the most autonomy. And I think they kind of screwed it up. I think they used a particular opportunity in Iraqi politics. This is 2017, 2018, thereabouts, to basically Islamic State came in. The Kurds very bravely, the Iraqi Kurds fought back against the Islamic State, were able to take a whole bunch more territory that had traditionally been more disputed between the Iraqi government and the Kurds. And then they decided to declare independence, at which point the Iraqi military marched into most of the disputed territory and really squashed down Iraqi Kurdish power. I believe the Iraqi Kurds are still autonomous, still have their own governing apparatus. In Syria, that's also the case, but I don't think it's going to last very long. And in Turkey, unfortunately, I'm not familiar with how things are going in Iran, but I assume it's not great. The mullahs don't strike me as the types to be super, super enthusiastic about giving autonomy. What's specific about the modern Turkish issue is that Erdogan came to power in part on the back of the Kurds and making great rhetorical gestures and some very real physical gestures towards the ideas of federalism within Turkey, more Kurdish autonomy in some limited respects, granted some aspects of that. And then in 2015, when he realized he was losing political sway with the Kurds, he turned against them in a massive, massive way. So we've got, I think, you know, in circa 2011, 2012, things were looking pretty great for Kurdish prospects of autonomy. You had the, even in 2014, 2015, you had the Iraqi Kurds taking big slices of the country as the Iraqi government failed in front of the Islamic State. You had autonomy growing in Syria. And then you had nominally, up until 2015, a Turkish government that was more friendly to Kurdish power than they ever have been. I would say most of that has been reversed. The Syrian Kurds still have some power, but it is incredibly, incredibly tenuous. And they're looking finally to make an accommodation with Assad again. So I'd say that the real chances of Turkish autonomy are essentially nil, I would say. I could be entirely wrong about that.
How, I think it's phrased as the Kurdish question. How has that been raised throughout the election?
Oh, man. Well, the surprising thing about the results of this election, so we had the initial election on May 14th, and on May 28th, the runoff election that I'm assuming that Erdogan has won. We don't know yet. And what was so shocking about Kılıçdaroğlu, who is the face of the old establishment, the CHP party, which was the party of Ataturk, what have you. And what's so shocking about this is that his party, which was traditionally a party that was associated with persecuting Kurds, got a dramatic amount of Kurdish support. So traditionally, the strongholds of the CHP are out in the west of the country, more westernized folks, traditionally wealthier folks, old school elites. Those are, say, Ankara and Istanbul, have been run by CHP mayors for the past 4 years now. But what was crazy about the electoral map on May 14th was it was the west of the country and also the east of the country going for the CHP, whereas Erdogan won the heartland. And that is a fascinating switch. I think it's worth possibly briefly going back to how this question arose. And I think that the incredible complexity of the Kurdish ethnicity, nation, what have you, I mean, goes back to disputes between the Ottoman Empire and the Safavid Persian Empire. And this is a similar problem with the Ottoman Empire's Arab dominions, was that when Islam was the glue that held together the empire, there was questions of ethnicity were a lot less important. The Turks and the Arabs and the Kurds were all under this one nominal caliphate. Maybe not just nominal, I don't know. And the problem was when the Ottoman state, and this was a long process, this started long before the Young Turks took over in, I believe, 1908. This started in the mid-19th century, when the Ottomans, who were just getting their asses handed to them left and right by national minorities, by Russian Empire, Russian nationalism, and French nationalism. The British were actually generally pretty supportive of the Ottomans for most of the time, but the Europeans were supporting nationalist groupings within the Ottoman Empire, and the Ottomans decided they need to figure out some way to retaliate and leaned more and more into Turkish identity in a series of steps. And as that happened more and more, the Ottoman state became less and less appealing to the Arabs and to the Kurds. The Kurds were at a lower level of economic development, you know, based out east. There was not a ton going on out there, whereas the Arabs had Cairo, they had Damascus, they had these sites of learning that were already building up national consciousness, so that you had serious Arab pushback against the Ottomans. That was a big dynamic during World War I. The Kurds were sort of a little bit behind that, and what the initial Turkish state did a fairly decent job of was co-opting the sort of Kurdish landlords that controlled most of that area. And unfortunately, this is a kind of grim dynamic, but never try to take away from the Turkish people in charge who were responsible for the Armenian genocide. But the Kurds, some Kurds acted as sort of foot soldiers of a lot of those massacres. So they'd sort of some rich elites among the Kurds had sort of initially benefited in this sort of interim period. There's this sense that we made promises to the Kurds in the West. And I think this comes down to the Treaty of Sevres, S-E-V-R-E-S. I'm not entirely certain how that's meant to be pronounced. This was the initial treaty that the Ottoman Empire was forced to sign, which essentially reduced Turkey to a little clutch of land in Anatolia. Actually, kind of reminiscent of the electoral map that votes for Erdogan, actually, now that you think about it, but much smaller. So they were meant to be just sort of carved up even worse than the Austro-Hungarian Empire was.
Was this when Kurdistan was nearly a possibility?
It was a possibility, and it was always much less of a possibility than I think. There's this sense that, oh, we've always been betraying the Kurds. And it's like the Treaty of Sevres was something that Ataturk reversed, essentially. Yes, and I would argue rightly. I mean, the victorious allies thought that they could just divide up modern Turkey, and that was an extraordinarily arrogant thing to assume that they could do, and they failed to. So also, the Greeks were going to take the entire Anatolian coast. That was something that the British actually supported the Greeks in attempting to do, and the Turkish War of Independence is celebrated every year because Ataturk was able to force the Greeks out. So I don't know that the Kurds at that point were really even that interested. There are absolutely, by the 1920s and into the 1930s, we have serious Kurdish inflected uprisings. Not yet, even in the 20s and 30s, not even yet in that truly sort of national sense, nationalist sense that we recognize from a lot of European history, but there were serious uprisings. The JHP, Ataturk's party, and now Kılıçdaroğlu's party became known as a party of repression for the Kurds out east. Yeah, and it was pretty grim. And that became a growing and growing thing until the 1970s, when, in part because there were more economic opportunities out east, greater literacy, more and more people became more aware of their distinctiveness as Kurds, became more interested in developing that further. And as that happened, with each of the coups that the Turkish military used to reassert itself, almost every coup would come in with a greater repression of the Kurds. You know, language is no longer allowed. Schools don't even think about it. Names have to change. This, that, and the other thing. And repression got worse and worse in through the, it depends on how you read it. I think debatably Turgut Özal in the 80s and the 90s attempted to sort of pull back a bit, but that actually was a point where the PKK from Syria, based in Syria, brought the wars between the Turkish state and the Kurdish nationalists to the highest pitch in the 1990s. And things get very, very grim. Figures like 30,000, 40,000, 50,000 dead people because of this conflict between the PKK, the Kurdish Nationalist Party, and the Turkish state. So pretty grim. Yeah, not great.
What Kurdish successes are there within Turkey? What is the thing people in Turkey really love the Kurdish for?
That's not... Well, it depends. The Turks, but again, and you know, there is no one Turk. I think that certainly there was a strange thing back in 2015. The HDP party, which was the latest iteration of the peaceful democratic representation of the Kurds, for the first time actually found itself supported by a wide range of Turkish liberals, for lack of a better word, liberals, leftists, the way that the terms are used, I've always found kind of confusing, more Western-focused, secular folks, voting for the HDP. And that was seen as like an extraordinary step forward by everybody. I had friends who sort of fit into that sort of leftist Western folk. I mean, it's very, very different. Leftist is very different from, you know, Western facing secular rich kids, you know, but they're both Western or secular, whatever, but who are very like patting themselves on the back. Like, how extraordinary is it that like we're actually voting for a Kurd? And, you know, in the spirit of, what's that movie, that Jordan Peele movie where the one before it, Get Out, where like there's the white suburban father who's so proud of himself for voting for Obama, even though it's later revealed there's all kinds of horrifying race-related things going on. It's along those lines of like, we voted for a Kurd, we're amazing. And that was an extraordinarily small slice of the Turkish population. So I think the Kurdish party would get through its own constituency normally, you know, 8 to 10%, and they won 13% in that. So maybe 5% of the Turkish population was willing to vote for a Kurd because they hated Erdogan so much, because that vote for the HDP helped Erdogan lose his majority. So unfortunately, like, this is a very long way of saying, unfortunately, Ruri, I don't think there's much about Kurds that most Turks like. I think they've been conditioned to see them as a threat. And I think that that conditioning has been vital to Erdogan's holding on to power in both the 2015 and the 2023 elections, which is quite sad.
It's looking likely that Erdogan's going to win the next round of voting. Do you think he's going to tighten the screws on the Kurds?
That's an interesting question. The screws are already pretty tight. The HDP, I'd mentioned the sort of peaceful democratic representation of the Kurds, since 2015, or maybe it was 2016 or so, the leaders of that party have been in jail. There is no question of them being released. HDP mayors tend to win local elections out east, and the Turkish government just replaces them with people that they like better. Often just incarcerating the mayors that win, the HDP mayors that win.
So it's very undemocratic.
It is pretty gosh darn undemocratic. But if there's a Kurdish population that votes for a AKP party mayor, that would be Erdogan's party, then, you know, that's great. And they're, you know, Erdogan's a big fan of Turkish, of Kurdish democracy that votes for his party. It is a very interesting and open question, not just with Kurds, but also with Syrians. To what degree will Erdogan act out on his negative rhetoric in the coming months and years? There's an argument that can be made like, well, he's gotten reelected, he's gotten his next 5 years here, he doesn't actually need to do anything. Unfortunately, the chances are pretty high that the Turkish economy is going to continue to fall apart. And what do you do when the economy falls apart? You blame the minorities.
So I've seen that people were the markets were expecting him to win, and the lira nosedived. It's now at the lowest rate it's ever been, 20 lira to the dollar.
Yeah, I think, including myself in this, I think a lot of people were very optimistic about the initial election on May 14th, and on Monday, when it became clear that Erdogan had won a much larger percentage than expected, all the indicators continued.
Everything tanked their
long-term slide.
And he's keen on not raising interest rates, isn't that right? Which then means inflation goes through the roof.
Yep, that's certainly what's been happening. That is certainly what has been happening. So to be clear, he did not outright win the first round of presidential elections. And, you know, for Turkey, for opponents of Erdogan, that is some degree of victory. The problem was that the expectation was that Kılıçdaroğlu, his opponent, was going to outright win. And what we got instead was a result where I think Erdogan was around 49% short of the 50%.
So was it 50% you need for the threshold?
Mm-hmm.
So Erdogan was just short.
Just short, and Kılıçdaroğlu was somewhere in the low 40s. And the balance was held by, I believe it's Sinan Oğan. The balance for 4 to 5% of the vote was held by a stridently nationalist third-party candidate. This is the now at least the second break-off nationalist party. Apparently, the MHP, the classic nationalist party run by Devlet Bahçeli, annoys everybody. So this is another nationalist group that is sliced off from that. But he made it very clear in the initial week after the runoff that there was no way that he would support Kılıçdaroğlu if Kılıçdaroğlu made any concessions at all to the Kurds or tried to put together a government that had any representation from the Kurds. So that's the Turkish nationalism, the MHP, the whatever Oğan's party is, the E party of Meral Akşener. That is, you know, hating on the Kurds is the basic platform of all of those parties. And so it's quite frustrating. And by the end of this past week, or the middle, or the beginning of last week, getting the math, it's a little confused in my head. Sinan Oğan ran himself as a presidential candidate.
Okay.
And he has endorsed Erdogan. So he, not in the first round of elections, had 4 to 5% of the vote that is now being thrown to Erdogan. So miracles are possible, but we know by the time you're listening to this that
it's unlikely.
Probably didn't occur. And I think it's probably worth going through the minutiae of the 2015 election, because it's a very similarly depressing dynamic here. In 2023, it seems likely that Erdogan is going to get back into power, because no matter how much the majority at this point of Turks are sick of him and would like to be rid of him, they are more concerned about Kurds, which is something that he's put a lot of effort into creating, a dynamic where people are more worried about Kurds. And that's tragic, but it's not the first time we've seen that. It's not even the first time we've seen that over the past 10 years. In 2015, as I mentioned, the HDP party made it over a sort of barrier to get to representation in parliament, and we had this incredible situation where the opposition parties in Turkey, this is, I believe, in June of 2015, I was dancing in the streets, could have created a coalition government that could have unseated Erdogan. Erdogan and the AK Party would have been out of power. There never would have been a coup. There never would have been a constitutional change. Turkey would have remained a parliamentary system. But the parties, the opposition parties, despite the fact that they had won an election, refused to work together. Neither the MHP nor, I believe, the E party was already a factor at that point, but don't quote me on that. I'm not 100% sure. The one or two nationalist parties refused to work with the HDP. And Erdogan managed to restart a massive conflict with the Kurds. And by November, the Turkish public was willing to vote for him and the Nationalist Party together in coalition, because the Nationalist Party came over to him because he switched from being a friend of the Kurds to being an enemy of the Kurds. And he's been in power ever since. And it's just tremendously frustrating that this issue has kept Erdogan in power and looks likely to have done so yet again.
Do you have any glimmers of hope for the next 4 years for the Kurds in Turkey? Is there, what do you see could help them?
The best case scenario is that Erdogan decides to sort of go back on his rhetoric. He's always looking for, you know, to build coalitions with folks. There are significant numbers of Kurds who support him. So I think the chances of going back to like full-on 1990s, the language is banned, seems unlikely to me. I think also there's, and I could be wrong about this, but my sense is that the Turkish military has largely consolidated power in the east, which may seem grim to some, but not so to me, because I think large-scale fighting in the east, which we had in 2015. I think that's a key thing that I just recently, reading these Erdogan I just read a selection of Erdogan biographies in preparation for the election, and I'd forgotten about this, but it's really true. I think that when we in the United States or Europe hear that Erdogan is angry about the PKK or hates Syria's Kurds, we sort of poo-poo it and like, oh, you know, what a schmuck. The Kurds are lovely. They're leftists. They give women machine guns. They're awesome. But in 2015, the PKK, more or less directly affiliated, I mean, the U.S. government managed to convince Syria's Kurds to set up a different, like, bureaucratic structure. But, like, when the PKK, when the Syria Kurdish groups, the SDF, the YPG, whatever they are, when they take over a town, they fly the flags with the face of the leader of the PKK. And in 2015, the PKK, the direct allies, if not the exact same people as Syria's Kurds, were fighting for territory in southeastern Turkey. So the Syrian civil war, in a very real sense, spilled over into southeastern Turkey. And you can make an argument that, oh, well, you know, Erdogan didn't have to send the military in, didn't have to. And it's like, well, I mean, how would the United States react to an argument that, oh, you know, you don't have to actually control the territory of your own country? We would react incredibly violently. And that's what the Turkish state did. But I just hadn't really, I mean, I was aware of that at the time, but I hadn't really just reflected on like what that signified. Like there was a real Kurdish threat. The Syrian Kurds did overreach and decide to start acting as if with U.S. funding, they could carve off slices of Turkish territory. And that's entirely understandable that that was unacceptable to the Erdogan government, that that would be unacceptable to any Turkish government. So while I do think it's a goddamn shame that Turkish hatred of Kurds has now given, Erdogan another election, it is true that U.S. sponsorship of Syria's Kurds really, really, really contributed to this problem in a huge, huge way. I've said it before and I'll say it again, without the conflict in Syria and without the U.S. role in the conflict in Syria, I do not believe Erdogan would still be in power. And it's quite straightforward. I mean, that the Kurdish issue that the U.S. exacerbated dramatically has been instrumental in keeping Erdogan in power in both 2015 and 2023.
Can you see Erdogan trying to get more land in Syria and fight off the YPG more? Or is he still kind of at the high water mark?
That's a really key question. He's been threatening it now since May of, it is May again, and he has been threatening since, it is May of 2023, and since May of 2022, he has been seriously threatening further invasions of Syria. I think what these are intended to do, and what should happen, frankly, is to force the Kurds to make some kind of accommodation with the Syrian government. This seems more outrageous to people because of a myth or a fabrication about the Syrian civil war that I think a lot of people are encouraged to believe. And this is the idea that the Kurds were rebelling against Assad. They were not. They never were. Only in the aftermath of massive UF support for the Kurds have the Kurds begun to be a little more insulting of Assad and have broken off relationships with him to some degree. When Aleppo, you remember the great conflict over Aleppo? You know, Aleppo was falling. The part that was falling was the never more than one third of Aleppo that was controlled by the largely Sunni jihadist rebels. The other two thirds of Aleppo were jointly controlled by the Assad government and the Kurds. So like the what happened out east was that the Assad government was like, I need to focus more resources on crushing these revolts in the parts of Syria where most people live along the coast there. Not exclusively along the coast, but you know, sort of more towards the west. So he pulled out of the east, largely handed power over peacefully to the Kurds with the understanding that they would maintain a more secular, more sane government than the jihadists he had to go back to the west to fight against. So you had, I think you still might have, now you've got much more because of different backs and forths of this sort of checkerboard territory, whereas Assad controls a little bit along the border here, and then the Kurds do, and then this. But even before that started becoming a factor after the Turkish invasion, Assad controlled military bases and had personnel in Rojava throughout the conflict until the United States started backing up the Kurds more directly and more largely, which got them to start stepping away from Assad. So I think Erdogan's hope and expectation, and my hope and expectation, frankly, is that the Kurds get back in bed with Assad. It goes back to being a unified national territory. And then at that point, negotiations can start between Assad and the Turkish government about Turkish withdrawal, which would unfortunately have to include large-scale repatriation of Syrian refugees, which is an incredibly grim topic that I am afraid we'll probably have to do episodes on in the future.
What's his name again? Darulu? I'm pronouncing that wrong.
Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu is the opposition.
Kılıçdaroğlu.
Yes.
Because he's been very big on sending refugees back, so I assume that would include a lot of Kurds.
I got some pushback on this from some Turkish folks on the Discord. And I think what's happened over the past 2 weeks is that, well, to be clear, there was the policy of the Kılıçdaroğlu, the opposition, was always sending Syrian refugees back. That has always been every Turkish party has to talk about that right now. They have taken in, I've read estimates, you know, I was always using the estimate of 3.5 million, but I've read estimates now that they've taken in 5 million refugees.
Well, because Darulu's claiming they've taken in 10 and it's all Erdogan's fault.
Kılıçdaroğlu, yes. Oh, Kılıçdaroğlu is claiming they took in 10 million refugees.
Mm-hmm.
Good golly gosh. To be clear, it absolutely is Erdogan's fault. Erdogan is, I think it was a sort of an interesting, did we talk about this here or was this elsewhere? It's like sort of in terms of responsibility for the Syrian war. Obama is the most guilty, is the most powerful actor involved. But I do think you can say in Obama's favor that he had limited choices. To some extent, he was backed into the corner of the military-industrial complex. This is what the United States does. We destroy countries. We like war. Assad was an official enemy for decades, and Obama was to some degree forced. He always gets the most blame for the 500,000 dead in Syria, as far as I'm concerned. But there are explanations. Assad, mass murderer, disgusting guy, no choices. His choices were essentially get Gaddafi'd or become a mass murderer. He literally, his life was in jeopardy. He had no choice other than to be this monstrous person that we forced him to be. So obviously Assad is a monster. I have no sympathy for him, but he had no choice in the matter either. So I don't think about him much in terms of blaming. Erdogan, another really, really key actor in making the war as bad as it was. And Erdogan was not constrained by the Turkish system. There was very little in the Turkish system that was like, yeah, let's go get into a war in Syria. No, this was Erdogan's choice for his own political benefit. And so when Kılıçdaroğlu says that Erdogan is responsible for all those refugees in Turkey, I think he's quite right. So Kılıçdaroğlu is certainly anti-Syrian refugees, as anybody who's trying to get votes in Turkey has to be at this point. The question is, to what degree? And I think over the past 2 weeks, between the initial election and the runoff election, when it became incredibly depressingly clear that hypernationalism was the way to potentially win this election, I think he did make further commitments as to timelines and strategies for brutalizing Syrian refugees. And the Kurds as well. I think he actually made some, I think he made some commitments, something along the lines of he was going to continue the Erdogan policy of not honoring the results of elections out east if they were
in Kurdish regions.
Yeah, in Kurdish regions. And that, and Erdogan went and endorsed Erdogan anyway.
But does this show just how unpopular the Kurds are, that both parties have to basically say, we'll make things as difficult for Kurdish people as we can?
100%. That is absolutely the case. But it's also, you can't let Erdogan off the hook here, because it was Erdogan who decided to launch
the... He switched from being helpful towards them to being their enemy, essentially.
Exactly. But before that, and what made that decision so much easier or seem necessary to him, was his choice to get involved in the Syrian war. It's that choice that a whole train of horrific consequences comes from. And it's his continued utilization. And I don't want to let him off the hook just because of what happened in Diyarbakir and Cizre. I think that in 2015, the Turkish state had to go in and reassert control of its own internationally recognized territory. But in the ensuing years, I mean, that was 2015, 2016, when the military fight against the PKK within Turkey and then within Syria has very much been won. But it is his choice to continue to keep this as such a live issue, such a live object. He has immense control over the Turkish media, over what people discuss. He's, even before he had the kind of power that he has today, back when I moved to Turkey, 2011, 2016, thereabouts, he would just masterfully drive the news cycle, kind of the way that Trump used to have complete power over the news cycle, but Erdogan would actually have that in service of an agenda, whereas Trump just had that in service to his own ego.
Service of chaos.
Yes, exactly. Erdogan usually had a sense of something he was moving towards. That is sort of an interesting question, is what actually is he moving towards at this point? For his entire, the first decade and a half, I'm not sure when he openly started going for this, but he clearly was interested in pushing Turkey towards a more presidential system and a system where more power was solidified under him, and he got it. Thanks to that coup in 2016 and the state of emergency that ensued, probably one of the most dubious elections of the past decade is the constitutional referendum in 2017 that was won by 1% during a state of emergency, which gave incredible powers to the government to do essentially whatever it wanted. That state of emergency is now over. He is the all-powerful president. He very likely, I mean, hopefully not, but he has very likely won re-election. What actually does he want at this point? Unfortunately, the somewhat depressing consensus I've seen is to just hold on to power as long as he's alive and keep enriching his family members. That's quite sad.
What effect are outside actors having on it, and what's the sort of international community's consensus?
It's interesting. The way this election has played out is kind of brilliant for Erdogan, honestly. I think there's a lot of stuff. This is pretty tenuous and based on my read of Twitter and Twitter's read on certain events. So take this with a boulder-sized grain of salt. But considering the amount of protesting of ballot boxes that Erdogan's party was doing on the evening of the election, it seems like they were putting things in place to steal the election if they needed to. But what happened, and this, what I'm saying right here, could be a consciously constructed narrative. So that also could be wrong. But what seems to have happened on that evening was they realized, actually, we've done well enough that it doesn't matter. Well, they didn't win. They did not. He did not win the initial thing. The election went to a runoff. But even that evening, they could see from the votes that this was going to be a runoff that very likely was going to be one that Erdogan won, with, you know, the nationalist having 5% and Erdogan being 0.5% away from the 50% he needed. So my sense is that, and this could be entirely unfair, but they were going to steal it. They were putting stuff in place to steal it, and then they realized they didn't have to. And that makes it much more difficult for folks to marginalize Erdogan. This is not some, well, classic Syrian election where, oh, look, Assad, you know, Hafez Assad won by 99% of the vote. You know, he scraped in with a bare majority, and that's how Erdogan has won all of his elections, is by the skin of his teeth, but by enough to have the majorities he needs to do what he does. And it seems like this 2-week question that doesn't seem to really be a question, or maybe it's all been upset, but that seems very unlikely. The fact that he's had so strongly contested an election that has seen him win again it's already, I think, confusing for people from the West who are used to just talking about Turkey as a Putin-esque system or a Russia-like. Wait, he's actually running an election? People really think this person can win? And that skepticism seems to have been borne out. Like, he has, you know, just won, and there are many, many possible ways he could have rigged this. Nobody disputes that he has unfair control of the media. But I think it does introduce doubt for him to win a two-part election by, you know, 53% or whatever the result was likely to have been. So I think it does make it harder for outside folks to further marginalize him. I mean, to be clear, like, he couldn't have been much more marginalized than he was in the fall of 2021. Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Yeah, that's the country. Yes. Russia's invasion of Ukraine made him much, much more valuable because of Turkey's positioning on the Black Sea. I expect there'll be some kind of deal between Erdogan and the United States to allow Sweden to enter NATO. That's another bargaining chip for him.
Because he's sort of doubling down and not letting them in at the moment. He's sort of talking about how Russia's a good friend and all this carry on.
Sure. I mean, that's how you market your position. You know, when this first became a controversy, what was it, 6 months back? I was like, absolutely, Finland and Sweden will be in by the end of the year. Finland is already in. And I assume Sweden will be by the end of the year as well. But yeah, he's sort of sweetening the pot or what have you. So I think that there was, if he had outright stolen the election, you know, Kılıçdaroğlu, who had gotten 55%, and then there was some kind of really blatantly, openly dictatorial clampdown, then there would have been more serious, maybe even real sanctions. To be clear, Turkey is currently sanctioned to some degree, but it's quite minor. Certain defense industry aspects. But the way that this election has gone actually makes it easier for Western elements to continue dealing with him, to get what they want out of him vis-a-vis Russia and Ukraine.
Which is ultimately bad for the Kurds.
Yeah. Bad for the Kurds, bad for the Turks, I would argue, bad for the Syrians. That's a really interesting question. What is he going to do in Syria? The momentum at this point seems to be towards accepting Assad back into sort of the Middle East community. The vibe for the past 3 to 6 months has been actually back to what the first decade of Erdogan's time in power was, which was the zero problems with neighbors policy put forward by Erdogan's foreign minister, Davutoğlu, who actually was part of the opposition in this past election. But in the Middle East, peace seems to be breaking out left and right. Assad seems to be welcomed back. It seems now, actually, that Erdogan is trying to court Assad to some degree. So who knows? Maybe there's a real potential for some kind of Turkish withdrawal, or maybe Erdogan decides that the economy collapses and he needs a bigger war to make him feel stronger, and he just goes and decides to conquer the rest of eastern Syria.
What's day-to-day life for the average Kurd? Are they, you know, would it be obvious to me if I were to be there that they're treated as a second-class citizen, or is it much subtler?
Much subtler. I think, and it's very regional. There are, in the 80s and 90s, there were much broader, as there was in Turkey more generally, there was much broader rural poverty. And it was rough life, rougher life out in the villages, maybe more 70s and 80s. In part, part of it was a positive push, so part as a pull factor, as Turkey had a pretty great economic 1980s and, 1980s, not 1990s. But even during the 1990s and certainly during the aughts, that pull to the big cities continued. But there was also the push factor of the massive insurgency and counterinsurgency in the 1990s between the Kurds and the Turkish government just emptied out swaths of these villages. And those folks went to large Turkish cities. And the incredibly happy story of Turkey over the past 30 years is those populations going from living in shanty towns to living in publicly funded housing or working their way up the ladder in a variety of ways. So I don't want to overstate this, but I think that choosing to be politically active as a Kurd is a tremendously dangerous choice. And that
there are a lot of assassinations?
Some assassinations, but I think freedom seems to be the main thing. You know, you win an election as a Kurdish
you'll
mayor,
end up in jail
the chances are high you'll end up in jail. There's just so many different avenues for incarceration or perhaps just losing loss of economic opportunities. That's part of the subtle cultural war that they make. It's if you're you can be a openly Kurdish politician, but if you're an openly Kurdish politician out east affiliated with Erdogan's party, that's something that you can do that's viable. So it's much more, as I said at the beginning, the Kurds are just so many in so many different positions. There still are rural poor Kurds who are, you know, tremendously abused and in a really marginalized, unpleasant situation. But the largest, this is a standard data point, the largest Kurdish city by far is Istanbul, the Western Turkish city, because that's where the money was made. And that's where Kurdish folks went in the largest numbers in the 80s, 90s, aughts, and teens. And there are a lot of folks who... See, what is available to Kurdish folks is they can just simply not, you know, decide not to be Kurdish anymore. As this was also a dynamic during the Armenian genocide for a surprisingly large population. And some people, you know, they don't have to openly renounce it. They just have to sort of go along, get along, and not be politically advocating for Kurdish causes. And they can have a normal or even very prosperous life in Turkey. Well, to the extent that anybody can have a very prosperous life in Turkey anymore. But that was one of the great solvents during Erdogan's period from when his party was elected in 2002 until 2015, when he was subtly pushing more and more towards Kurdish opening. The economy was a tremendous aid to that. Because all of these issues become less of a problem. Problems of dividing the pie are less of a problem when the pie is bigger and getting bigger. And the pie is no longer getting bigger.
If Erdogan started to listen to traditional wisdom when it came to economics. Could you see Turkey doing well again?
I think that there's so much that's wrong. The problem with adopting economic orthodoxy all of a sudden is that it absolutely would bring what's left of the Turkish economy to a crashing halt.
So it's almost gotten used to the way things are?
I don't know that anybody can get used to. The last time I was in Turkey, we go out for drinks, and it was the perusing of the menu was, what do you think this price is like? Well, the beer seems like a good price, I think, and the wine seems completely outrageous. That's insane. That can't be right. And just every economic transaction in Turkey right now is like, is this what things are worth now? And that's like on it. So nobody can become comfortable with that. But the refusal to raise interest rates, surprisingly, and it has actually led to a fair amount of economic growth. The sign points, the point system, the money denominations, the costs for things are completely out of whack. But that's more of a problem for folks who want to interact internationally. I think there's a lot of folks who are just interacting within the Turkish economy. Not a lot of folks. I think everybody's feeling the pinch and feeling the pain. But there is economic activity going on. And to crash down those interest rates, which is sanity requires, and Kılıçdaroğlu would have to do if he were to come into power, would instantly yield a massive economic crash that would necessitate an IMF bailout and incredibly generous outside investors on top of the IMF bailout. So like, and whereas Kılıçdaroğlu could have expected friendly treatment from the IMF and potentially Europe and the United States just piling in investment-wise, if Erdogan were to all of a sudden be like, you know what, I give up, let's raise interest rates, the economy crashes, and nobody's there to bail him out. So it really is just this incredible pile of spinning plates spinning in the air. And
that only Erdogan can do.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, I'd never go this way, but I mean, some people are saying it's actually for the best that Erdogan won this because he's finally going to reap the rewards of the crisis he's started. I don't think that's sane. The depth of the economic fallout here is going to be so catastrophic. Wishing that on anybody is if Kılıçdaroğlu had won, and who knows, maybe he did. Probably not. But if Kılıçdaroğlu had won, he would have absolutely been remembered as a failed president, but he would have started the process of
the recovery of post-Erdogan.
Yes, getting Turkey back on a trajectory as a growing developed country, frankly. I think this is oversold because folks really, really, really hate Erdogan and don't want to give him credit for anything. But there was a financial crisis in 2001 or 2000 or 2001, I can't quite recall, which is the reason that Erdogan's party, the AK Party, won in the parliamentary elections in 2002. But before they came to power, there was a finance minister, I guess, who just died, actually, over the past couple of weeks. I can't remember his name, unfortunately, who was a member of the GHP or some other one of those more establishment parties. And everyone wants to give him credit for, like, putting the reforms in place that Erdogan was able to take advantage of. And I think that's a little unfair. It's like Erdogan was in power for, you know, an incredibly successful decade. They did it, must have done a few things right. But I do think that Kılıçdaroğlu could have come to power, could have played that role of doing the necessary deals with the IMF, making the necessary painful reforms, and then setting somebody else up for success. I think Erdogan is just, all the plates that he's juggling are just going to crash around him. And it's going to be really bad for...
Because the worst Turkey is, the worst things are going to be for the Kurds, because they do seem to get the blame.
Oh, no question. Well, I mean, unfortunately, at this point, I guess fortunately for the Kurds, but very unfortunately for the Syrian refugees, the Kurds are number two in line for the... it's interesting because I just don't... I could be entirely wrong about this, but my sense is that the Kurds are coming up again around election time because the Kurdish vote is very important. But I don't see Kurdish struggles as being that active an issue. I think, unfortunately, with the incredibly draconian, brutal actions, I think understandably in Turkey and unforgivably in Syria, the Turkish state and military has pretty crushed the potential of Turkish nationalism to have a real impact in, sorry, Kurdish nationalism to have a real impact within Turkey. So I think now that the election recedes, the focus is going to go back to Syrian refugees. And they are a much more truly maligned and marginalized. I don't want to undersell Kurdish marginalization, but there's a much broader range of experiences there. The 5 million Syrian and other, I think it's, it might be like 3.5 Syrian refugees and then 1.5
Between
million
two
other.
And 10.
Other. Yeah, 1.5 other million refugees. It's very difficult to, between 2 and 10, yes, nice broad range there. And that those are the folks that I'm most worried about in the coming dispensation. Because at the end of the day, even the worst Turkish nationalist does not recognize Kurds, but recognizes the people, the Kurdish people, as Turks who belong in Turkey, who... you know, maybe should be in a subordinate position until they learn better Turkish or whatever, but like belong there. I do think that it's a serious question how the refugee population is going to be treated in Turkey in the coming months and years. And a much darker question, potentially.
And on that cheery note, we will catch you next time.
The More Freedom Foundation is also available on YouTube and TikTok. Rob's Twitter is Rob O'Law, and he's also written a book called Avoiding the British Empire, What It Was and How the US Can Do Better. And music provided by Kevin MacLeod.